tips. Okay. We are, I think, on, but I'm going to double check that. We are. Hi. I'm a little loud, aren't I? All right, keep you awake. On the screen, and this is on the website, too, but in case you didn't see it yet, because you haven't checked the website this afternoon since I updated it, next week, a week from today, here, conveniently right after class, there is a lecture by William Julius Wilson, and it's a not-to-be-missed lecture. So whatever you have planned for after class, cancel it. And my guess is that you will be very fortunate because you will have a seat. If you just stay here, you'll have a seat. And the other people who will be waiting outside will have to stand up, and probably about that time they'll have to move the lecture to some larger hall. For those of you who don't recognize his name, William Wilson is a professor at Harvard, as it probably says up there, yes. He is one of the clearest and most informed voices about racial tension and race relations in our society, and has spent most of his career studying urban ghetto neighborhoods and studying them to find out what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, how people get out of them, what kinds of programs work and don't work. He is an unusually articulate and forceful speaker. I think you'll find him, I have always found him when I've heard him, extremely provocative and informative. He spent most of his career up until about 10 years ago at the University of Chicago and then moved to Harvard, but he still studies the neighborhoods in Chicago that he's been studying, and has been an advisor to presidents who have been interested in why our programs don't work very well and how they could work better. So anyway, I recommend it very highly, and I'm only concerned that they'll make us leave early. But we will fight that. Okay. We're going to pick up where we left off in a minute, and we'll stop early and give you back the exams. So before we jump in, I want to put this up on the overhead, which was where I ended, I believe, and ask if there are any questions about the beginning of cognitive development or anything that I said on Monday or anything else. I'm not getting emails from you asking questions about the text or my lectures or life, so I feel kind of rejected, useless, isolated, neglected. So if you don't have questions by email and I don't get letters from you and I don't get questions here, okay. Julie will go among you over the next couple of weeks and plant questions. Right. Okay, so we can talk about that. So I'm just going to talk about what I want to talk about then. Where we were was looking at the fact that the brain receives and perceives in several different modes, taking in information from the senses, and that it can create schemas or familiar patterns in all of the modes in which it receives information. And as we develop the patterns that it can represent, that the brain can represent, become more and more complex and more interrelated to each other. One way to think about intelligence is to think about it as the ability to create complex schemas and to use those schemas to interpret the world that you're in and to adapt your behavior according to the understanding that you've developed. So that's one way to think about intelligence, the ability to represent your experience and to use that experience, those representations, to think about them, to interpret the world, and to adapt your behavior so that you survive. If you think about intelligence that way, then one of the questions that often we seem to be interested in is, why are some people more intelligent than others? And by that kind of definition, we would say that the person who was more intelligent was able to create more complex schemas and or create them more quickly and or apply them more efficiently and or adapt his or her behavior more successfully. And it's highly questionable whether an IQ test actually would measure that kind of difference among us. But one way to think about being very intelligent is that you can create very complex schemas, you can process them quickly, and then use them. And we'll talk about an approach that uses that kind of definition. The question I want to move to is, what becomes of those different modes or types of thinking? If you're developing schemas in different areas, sound, images, motor skills, textures, if you're developing complex schemas in each of those, how do we see those as we develop? And one of the approaches is that of Howard Gardner, who's mentioned in your text. Howard Gardner suggests that as we look at a brain and a mind that resides in that brain, that those schemas that are developed from different kinds of information lead to the development of different kinds of intelligence. And Gardner asked himself the question a number of years ago, why do we think that there is only one human intelligence? Where did that notion come from? That it's really not a very useful idea, because there are many different ways to be intelligent. So Gardner has developed what we call the theory of multiple intelligences, to suggest that the fact that the brain processes different kinds of information in different parts of it, so you have a visual cortex, you have an auditory cortex, you have an abstract thinking cortex, if we think about the fact that the brain processes different kinds of information in different places, then we might also think about examining whether each of those types of information lead to a specific kind of intelligence. And it might be useful to think about people having 6 or 8 or 10 different intelligences that come together in our thinking. And that has turned out to be a provocative and a very useful idea. Now, how would you define some kind of performance or information or type of schema? How would you define it as an intelligence? What would it take for something to qualify? And Gardner, who's a psychologist at Harvard, who just retired, Gardner had been working with patients who had experienced brain damage. And if you remember, I said a week ago that one of the ways we know about the brain and its specific functions is by looking at people who've suffered damage to some particular part of the brain. And as we look at people who have damage in a particular part of the brain, we see that a particular aspect of their thinking or their processing is affected by that specific damage. So what Gardner did was say, well, if that's the case, then if we can isolate a particular kind of skill to a particular part of the brain, then maybe it represents an evolved kind of intelligence. So he set that as his first criteria. So he was looking at patients who had various kinds of aphasia or disordered thinking, very specific kinds of thinking, who had experienced brain damage in a particular area. So let's start there, he said, and that'll give us an idea of where to start. Then, let's see if when there's brain damage, if we can also see that some people are really, really, really good in that particular kind of thinking. Now, let me give you an example of that. One of the potential intelligence in his thinking was music. It happens that Gardner, in addition to being a psychologist, is a fairly good musician. And he was aware that he thinks in music, he thinks musically, he thinks about music differently than he thinks about psychology. So he said, what if we, and we know that some people who have brain damage in a particular part of the brain lose their ability to appreciate music or to produce it, or in some cases everything to them becomes connected to music. So it's potentially isolatable, and there are clearly prodigies and other exceptional individuals in that particular kind of thinking. Mozart was improvising on the piano when he was 3 or 4 years old. He was an incredible genius in regard to music. You know, some of you are aware that Mozart could do things like take a piece and play it forward, which is the way we usually play our music. And then he could take the same piece and play it backward from memory. And one of his other party tricks, and he really did this at parties, was he would then take the piece and play it upside down. How do you play music upside down? He would turn the music over if it was printed, or in his head he would transpose by flipping the staff upside down. So if a note was in the top space on the staff in the original piece, it would be in the bottom staff on the upside down piece. And he would play the piece as if it had been written upside down. Whoa! And there are other people who can do that kind of thing. So Gardner said, well, if we have prodigies and we have damage affecting that particular area, then we know we have different kinds of brains at work. And we can talk about an identifiable core operation or set of operations. What does that mean? It means that you can represent the particular kind of thinking that might represent an intelligence, and you can communicate about it, and there are particular mental operations that are used in thinking about music, or in this case, music. So in the case of operation in music, we have rhythm, we have pitch, we have harmony, and we can talk about those, and every piece of music has those. It ain't music if there's not variation in pitch, and it helps if there is some kind of reasonably steady rhythm. So we can talk about that, and we can change it. We can change the rhythm of a piece. We can change the time signature. We can change the key that it's in. We can transform it from major to minor. Those are all operations, a set of operations that we do to music. A distinctive developmental history. We can watch children develop music. We can watch their reactions to music. We can watch how they learn about it. We can watch them develop the ability to produce music. And we see that in the case of music, as one of the examples, all children produce music. They all sing. They all change the pitch and change the rhythm of what they're saying. That's one of the things that infants and toddlers do. They play with pitch. They play with rhythm. They alternate it. And they develop the little sing songs. You know, Mommy's going to the store. You know, Mommy's coming. Daddy's coming home. Mommy's coming home. Those are songs. And children produce those pretty spontaneously. There's a distinctive developmental history to the use of music. And we can define what an expert is. I've given you the example of Mozart. He was a pretty expert. There's an evolutionary history and plausibility. Now, these are our potential criteria. This is what he's saying. We're going to have to see this in order to say that something is a separate intelligence. Evolutionary history. How many organisms produce music? Well, actually, quite a few produce music. You know any? Any of you? Whales. Okay, they're pretty far up on the evolutionary scale. Whales. In fact, all of the aquatic mammals, as far as I'm aware, do produce sound that we call music, but anyway, they produce rhythm and pitch and vary it. Birds, okay. Songs, bird song, some insects. Okay. So there's a pretty good argument that there's some evolutionary history, and plausibility means it makes sense, you know, as a way of processing information and perhaps sharing it, communicating back and forth. Can you produce experimental psychological tasks? Yeah. Can you measure musical ability? Yeah, probably. And can you make a symbol system? Sure, you can write music. We learn to do that. Okay, so that's a symbol system. Musical notes on staff are a symbol system. Yes. This, what kind of psychometric finding would you have? Let's see, what could we measure? We could measure the ability to maintain rhythm and shift rhythm. Okay, a basic task. We could measure the ability to repeat rhythms. So to hear a rhythm and store it in memory and repeat it back would be a psychometric a measure of some kind of rhythmic ability, and we would see individual differences in that. And that's why you would do a psychometric you'd want to measure differences. So some of us have no sense of rhythm. You know, you've danced with those people, right? And others of us pick up rhythms very quickly and can do all kinds of things with them. And I'll play with an example of that in a minute. We can measure pitch accuracy. You know, some of us have perfect pitch. I don't. Some of us can match pitches pretty well. Some of us can tell whether a note is a C sharp, or whether it's between a C sharp and a B flat. That's a pretty important skill if you're singing in an a cappella group. And there are differences among us in the ability to do that. One of the things that we might look at would be the ability to transpose. Can you switch keys for a particular song? And I like talking about music because I once was very close to a young woman who, impressed me one day. We were driving in the car, it's my daughter. We were driving in the car, and we were going to a fife and drum corps performance. And if you've ever been in a very early Toyota Tercel, they're very small and they're very tinny. And she wanted to practice her music in the car. You don't put a fife to your lips, and it's a wooden flute about this long, and it's really shrill, you know, military. So you can't play that in the car on a cold day because you'll deafen your father and give him a headache, even though he loves the music. But she wanted to practice, so I wouldn't let her. She did start the fife, and she was in about 8th grade, 7th grade. And she started to practice. She pulled out of her backpack one of her penny whistles, which she also played. She also played saxophone. And she started practicing her fife pieces on a penny whistle. And then a little later she stopped, and then she picked up another penny whistle. How many of you play penny whistle? Okay. Yeah. Why do you have a whole pocket full of penny whistles? A penny whistle player has a whole pocket full of penny whistles because each is in a specific key, and you can't change the key. So if you have a piece that you want to play in the key of C, you need a key of C penny whistle. And if you want to transpose that piece to F sharp, you need an F sharp penny whistle. When you change penny whistles and keys, you also have to change the fingering for some pieces. So here was my daughter. I realized after a while that she was playing the same piece on different penny whistles, and I knew that she could play it on the fife. And she was switching back and forth without much thought, and it suddenly occurred to me that she was transposing. She was taking a piece that she knew in the key of C on the fife, and she was picking up a D penny whistle or an E penny whistle or a G penny whistle, and she was playing it, playing the same piece in a different key. And as I finally began to understand what she was doing, I said, well, how do you do that, since I've never been able to transpose at all? She said, I don't know. And I said, well, you know what you're doing, don't you? And she said, no, I'm playing my music. And I said, well, what you're doing is playing into different keys. Oh, okay. And she knew that that meant she was transposing it. So the question was, how do you know the music? How do you know the piece? What's represented in your head if you can transpose it? She didn't know the fingering. If you transpose it visually, if you write it out in the symbol system and change keys, the notes are in a different place on the staff. So it's a different piece. So if you memorize the music by memorizing where the notes are on the staff, transposition requires a